Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We are just learning that Boeing may be under federal investigation. About an hour ago, reports broke that the Securities and Exchange Commission has questions about Boeing's 747 and Dreamliner programs. Also, we've been hearing that Boeing is planning layoffs, and today Boeing's stock has dropped 11%, the second biggest one-day percent drop in the past 15 years. What does all this mean for Boeing? Aerospace analyst Richard Abilafia is with us. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
So it's been reported that the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission is looking into whether Boeing properly accounted for the cost and sales of the 787, that's the Dreamliner, and the 747. What could an SEC investigation mean for Boeing?
Well, obviously nothing's been confirmed yet about whether it's happening and the nature of it all, but if it is happening, there is the threat of the company having to take some kind of forward loss on the basis of its, well, almost $30 billion in deferred production costs related to the 787 program.
Well, it sounds like an accounting thing, so why would this be significant for the company?
Well, the sheer amount of money involved, no one really knows how Wall Street will react to the prospect of a very large forward loss. And, of course, that just puts further pressure on their profitability, quite possibly, just as the market is peaking and there are all these macroeconomic dark clouds over the jetliner market. So it's a combination of bad news this morning.
Okay, so let's pull apart some of what we're talking about. Boeing's been trying to cut the cost of the Dreamliner for years. How successful have they been?
You know, pretty good, but they're still losing money on each one that they deliver. The last quarter saw them losing basically $6.5 million every time they delivered a 787, but this was down from hundreds of millions at the start. Still, it's very unusual for a program to be losing money like this at this stage when you've delivered already 300 aircraft.
Now let's talk about, as I mentioned, the reports that Boeing is about to lay off workers. Why would that be?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. First of all, they're convinced, or at least stating, that Airbus is competing heavily on price. There's almost certainly some truth in that, but I'm not really sure that's the full story. The reality is that one of their models, the 737 MAX 9, is having a very hard time against the A321neo. And that lack of traction in the market for that model could be leading the company to aggressively pursue an all-new jetliner, the 7M7, the middle-of-the-market jet that would basically take the place of the 757 back from the 10 years ago. But there's also just the prospect of the broader market's problems. You know, right now, the company is providing very rosy expectations for the next 4 years with rates on the 737 to get up to 57 per month. But outside of our industry, outside of airline profits, airline yields, and all these other good things that are doing pretty well, you've got the world economic environment with a lot of question marks over it. And, of course, the price of fuel has plummeted, which will likely lead to at least some airlines questioning whether they need new jets to replace the old ones.
Oh, yeah, I thought of plummeting prices as being good for travel, good for planes, good for Boeing, but not necessarily so. I just want to know, when we say layoffs, how many layoffs are you expecting, and what could that mean for local jobs here in Western Washington?
You know, it's just impossible to say at this point. It's also impossible to say how many will be through attrition rather than actual outright layoffs. And, of course, they're talking more middle management at first. We don't know the magnitude of all of this, and we don't even know if there will be outright layoffs. But, of course, there is that multiplier effect. It's not just the workers, but it's the people who profit when workers spend their salaries. But we just don't know the extent of it at this point, I'm afraid.
Why do you think Boeing's stock dropped so much today?
Well, obviously, you get that SEC in the headlines, and that just scares people. I think that's a big part of it. Part of it is also the rather rosy approach that they had taken in their fourth quarter earnings call, where they implied that everything was just fine. There was no pricing pressure, and the outlook was really good. And now here you've got the need to lay off workers because of pricing pressure. That juxtaposition really has people frazzled.
And let's remember that Boeing stock has been on an incredible run. It's still, what, 30% higher than it was 3 years ago. And finally, Richard Abulafia, let's just sum up here. We've been talking about layoffs, a possible Securities and Exchange Commission investigation. Pulling back now, what do you think Boeing's future looks like?
Well, you know, at the end of the day, the fundamentals are solid because people want to travel. They have to travel. The jetliner industry is solid. There are very high barriers to entry, and this is a very well-run duopoly between Airbus and Boeing. It's not like there's anyone from a third party that's suddenly going to emerge as a major player. And most of all, Boeing's jetliner product line and its new development product roadmap are really solid. What you've got is a couple of very, very negative headlines that I think are coloring people's perceptions. And there could be further bad news to come, but that's all tactical rather than strategic.
We've been talking about the biggest employer in the Puget Sound area. Richard Abulafia is an aerospace analyst with the Teal Group Corporation, filling you in on the latest with Boeing. Richard, thank you.
Pleasure.
KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Now let's move to the other big story that's happening today, the 41-day occupation of Oregon's Malheur Wildlife Refuge is over. After a long night of negotiations with the FBI, occupiers Jeff Banta and Sean and Sandy Anderson surrendered this morning. They were recorded in a live audio feed on YouTube.
All right,
guys.
You guys are coming out.
You guys are coming out?
How many people are live streaming this?
We got 18,000 watching right now.
So those three occupiers walked out, but the fourth militant stayed behind. That was 27-year-old David Fry.
Unless my grievances are heard, I will not come out.
Unless my grievances are heard, I will not come out. In fact, at one point, Fry threatened to either kill himself or be taken down.
I'm actually feeling suicidal right now.
Well, don't feel
no,
that
David,
way.
That doesn't help anybody, David. That really doesn't help anybody. It doesn't help you, it doesn't help us, and as a matter of fact, you will take away every bit of progress that we've made.
For more now on what's happening in Oregon, we go live to Oregon Public Broadcasting reporter Anna Griffin. Hi, Anna.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you. Why did these occupiers finally surrender after a long holdout at the wildlife refuge?
Well, it was 41 days that actually ended very quickly in the last 18 hours or so. Yesterday afternoon, one of the occupiers, we believe it was David Fry, was seen on an ATV beyond the barricades that had been set up. That prompted federal agents to surround the spot where the occupiers had been camping and essentially demand an ending. Negotiations went on last night on that YouTube live stream between the feds, between the occupiers, between a Nevada state legislator, Michelle Fiore, between a conservative commentator named Gavin Seam. And then this morning, as you noted, three of them left as agreed upon. And Fry, as I think anybody who's been following the situation and knows his background, not surprisingly, initially refused to go. Once the feds had everyone surrounded, they couldn't then walk away. They had to play this thing out. And just thankfully, it ended peacefully.
How did that happen?
The conversation I think a lot of us are going to be having in the next few days is whether this live stream actually saved this young man's life. When Gavin Seam began broadcasting his phone call with the occupiers last night, Fry was screaming at the federal negotiator. They were all talking about having their guns at the ready, being ready to fire. Having someone to talk to who was clearly sympathetic to them, who was essentially giving them their talking points back to them about the federal government and Obama and religion, seemed to give them something else to focus on and de-escalate. And I don't know what kinds of conversations were happening offline between lawyers and Michelle Fiore and federal negotiators, but it really was this situation where we heard it playing out in real time, the conversation get calmer, the conversation turn from we're never leaving to, yeah, okay, here are the ways that we would leave.
Catch us up on this live stream you're talking about on YouTube. How did that get set up and who was talking?
Well, the world of sort of extremism media, a lot of it takes place online, on YouTube, on social media sites. Gavin Seam is a former candidate for Congress, a conservative commentator, a bit of an activist who does this sometimes. One of the other occupiers who has been arrested is Pete Santilli, who is another advocate/journalist. And so you have these folks kind of blurring the line between we're on your side, but we're also expressing our First Amendment rights as quasi-journalists. Seem, I think they called him or he called them, and then they requested that Michelle Fiore get on the line, this Nevada state legislator, and then they just stayed live for hours last night and then hours again this morning. It was a little akin to if you could be inside the White Bronco with O.J. Simpson as he live streams himself, them this morning staying on the phone as they surrendered to federal agents.
So you have this conservative lawmaker, conservative talk show host, Reverend Franklin Graham, the son of Billy Graham, was talking. I could imagine all of this just amping up the situation. You say maybe there's a possibility of things ended peacefully with these four. I just wonder, what do you think are the ethics of what might be a new way for a standoff like this playing out?
I think that's the thing we all kind of have to wrestle, both media organizations and individuals, with our own consciences, because at one point this morning there were 20,000 people online listening to a very troubled 27-year-old man, very young, all things considered, talking about killing himself, talking about committing suicide by cop. The people who were on the other end of the phone, Gavin Seam, and at a certain point today, Chrisanne Hall, who's bills herself as sort of a constitutional expert, another conservative activist, they were essentially playing the role of negotiators, trying to talk him out of doing harm, trying to talk him into, okay, get up off the bed, walk outside. It was at the same time riveting and also incredibly disturbing radio drama.
We've been talking about the end of the 41-day occupation of Oregon's Malheur Wildlife Refuge. This has just unfolded here today, and we're talking with Oregon Public Broadcasting reporter. We're talking about this with Anna Griffin and wondering what happens now, Anna.
Well, we're all breathing a sigh of relief that it ended peacefully, but it's nowhere near over. The refuge remains a crime scene. There is a lot of evidence left to process. There is a lot of cleanup to be done. The Burns Paiute tribe, Native American tribe, is very concerned about what's happened to thousands of artifacts they have stored there. Back in Portland, you have 16 people who have been indicted, including the last four occupiers. I don't think anyone expects those court cases to be tidy or quiet. Cliven Bundy, the father of Eamon Bundy, who was sort of the organizer of this occupation, came to Portland last night to argue on behalf of his sons, was arrested at the airport on charges related to his 2014 armed standoff with federal agents in Nevada. So the circus has moved, but it's not over.
Cliven Bundy under arrest, artifacts and a crime scene, all this is happening. And meanwhile, this big debate that goes on over the federal government's use of so much land here in the West. And talking with us live, Anna Griffin, reporter with the Oregon Public Broadcasting. Anna, thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Have a good day.
And the same to you. It's KUOW's The Record. Coming up on The Record, you've heard of the meet-cute story, the sweet, charming, funny way that two people find each other. What you're about to hear, it's the opposite of that.
I was working with the U.S. Marines as translator. He was one of the soldiers with the new Iraqi armies.
How two Iraqis fell in love during wartime and then spent years fighting to be together and be safe. That's coming up in about 30 minutes here on KUOW Seattle. It's 20 minutes after 12 o'clock. Thank you for tuning in this afternoon. I'm Bill Radke. You know about the struggle to help homeless people in Seattle and King County and beyond. Well, now we're going to look at the special challenge faced by homeless couples without kids. Most shelters cater to women or men, but not both. So how do you get off the street without leaving your partner behind? KUOW's Kate Walters reports on one couple's struggle.
Lisa Sawyer and Stephen Drogos have been together for about 6 years. They met volunteering at a food bank. At first, she was shy and pretended to be interested in a book he was reading.
Yeah, she wasn't very interested in the book.
No, I
didn't know it was me.
I wasn't interested in a book, but I was definitely interested in him.
About 3 years ago, the place they were renting together burned down. They didn't have savings or relatives to turn to, so they ended up on the street, and it's been that way ever since.
If you can have a couple go outside on the streets and live like that. You test one another. And if you're still together after 3 or 4 years of living on the streets, there's something there.
There's times I want to strangle his neck, and there's times he wants to strangle mine, and we're still here. So, hey.
Sawyer and Drogo's both work. She sells the Real Change street paper downtown, and he works at a laundromat in South Park and with a local construction company. But it's still not enough to get them into stable housing. They bounce around. Sometimes they're on the street, sometimes they stay with friends. Right now.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi.
They're living in a rundown hotel near SeaTac Airport.
Bathroom area / kitchen. You have a microwave, you get the sink. You have just enough room for two people.
It's cleaner than some hotels they've stayed in. There are no bed bugs. And at $50 a night, it's cheaper than hotels closer to the city. But there are other hidden expenses, like food and transportation. Drogo says that's just part of hotel living.
You have to hustle every day. You have to have, and with two people, even if it's, say it's $50, if you have $25 a piece, then you got your night. But you have to work.
If they don't make their $50, they'll be back on the street. And shelters aren't an option because they usually won't take couples. Sawyer and Drogo's would have to split up.
So we say, oh, forget about it. You know, we don't want to separate.
And that reaction is pretty common.
There are often couples who are not in a position to separate, nor do they have a desire to separate in order to have a roof overhead. And so we hear time and time again from our shelter providers that they are turning folks away.
That's Jason Johnson, Deputy Director of the Department of Human Services for the City of Seattle. He says the city knows there's a service gap for couples without kids, but opening a shelter for couples isn't easy. You have to think about safety and
transforming a space into one that has walls and doors that lock, sort of the things that a couple would need, does get very costly.
But there are alternatives to shelters, Johnson says. There are the city-run tent camps, hotel vouchers for short stays, and then there's the rapid rehousing program. That's the model the city is pushing.
Rapid rehousing as a model is housing first, getting people back into permanent housing with the use of flexible funding.
All right, here's how it works. Rapid rehousing gives a one-time injection of funds to help people get into housing. You can get first and last month's rent and security deposit. Rent might also be subsidized for a short time. And people can get help finding stable employment. The programs can be funded at any level, from the city to the federal government, and they're run by service organizations. This model is considered best practice nationwide. And in cities like New Orleans, where rents are low and housing abounds, these programs are very successful. But in places like Seattle,
I think it is difficult to find housing that's affordable, as well as housing that may be owned or managed by someone who, in this environment, does not have to take a risk on someone who may have a spotty rental history or an eviction or a low-wage job or maybe even no job.
Lisa Sawyer and Stephen Drogos know this struggle well. They've been enrolled in a federally funded rapid rehousing program for months. Despite the help the program offers, they still can't find anyone who will rent to them. And they say it's because they're homeless.
We do have jobs. I do have references and all that. So,
yeah, we have
no evictions, no criminal records, nothing like that.
We have good credit. We still can't get in. If they find out you're homeless for a certain amount of time, they won't rent to you.
People working with rapid rehousing programs say this struggle is not unique. But there are people willing to rent to the homeless. You may just have to go outside Seattle. Jim Brass manages several properties out in Auburn. He's worked with rapid rehousing clients many times. He says it takes some of the risk out of renting to people who are homeless, and he's had as much success with rapid rehousing tenants as anyone else.
They're very careful not to break any rules. They don't want to lose this one last chance that they're getting. It's very, very important to them.
Brass knows this feeling firsthand. About 12 years ago, he and his wife became homeless. And he says rapid rehousing could have saved them a lot of pain.
It would have made the difference in getting us a new start, but we had to wait a year and a half and scrimp and save and try to go through things. So that our heart goes out to those same people. We know what can happen.
For Sawyer and Drogos, they say it would change everything if a landlord gave them a chance. It would give them confidence and stability.
It would mean
Tears of joy because I always dream of having my own place. It'd be amazing. It would be life in heaven.
Both Seattle and King County are ramping up funding for rapid rehousing programs. Officials say it's an important piece of the puzzle when it comes to addressing the homelessness crisis. For KUOW, I'm Kate Walters.
You can find that story along with related information and further coverage of the homeless issue at KUOW.org.
This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Tacoma could become home to the biggest methanol refinery in the world. Methanol is also known as wood alcohol. It can kill you if you drink it, but it's great for making plastics and solvents, biodiesel, paints, antifreeze, and other chemicals. The Chinese government wants more methanol, so they are the lead investor in this proposed Tacoma refinery. Our EarthFix reporter, Ashley Ahern's with us. Ashley, why are some people unhappy about this proposed Tacoma plant?
Well, as you said, the scale of this thing, the scope of it, is a real turnoff to a lot of people. But it also raises that question of, we have a lot of plastic pollution in the environment already. Do we want to kind of be enabling further production of plastics globally? And there's, you know, concerns about property values if you have something this big that goes in. This stuff is flammable. It is toxic to humans and animals, even though it does break down in the environment fairly quickly. It sparked a real heated debate, especially since Tacoma has such a strong blue-collar workforce and has a real industrial history. So there are many who support the proposal and say, you know, doing it cleanly in the Northwest with our natural gas, with our hydropower electricity, is the best way you can be making this stuff if you're going to be making methanol as the feedstock for plastics globally, and the plastics that we use in our fleece jackets and our kayaks and our yoga mats.
As the company likes to point out. Yes, you are probably using it. You said big. How big would this methanol plant be?
That's been the most interesting thing, just looking at the numbers on this thing. So it would use 10.4 million gallons a day of water. That is about 20% of the total amount of water that Tacoma Public Utilities supplies its people. And this, the utility supplies for Joint Base Lewis-McChord. I mean, it's not just the city of Tacoma that we're talking about. And then on the electricity side, it's 400 to 450 megawatts is the demand for this thing. To give you some sense, all of the Tacoma Utilities customers, 550 megawatts. So you're looking at almost doubling the electricity needs for, based on this, just this one project going into this city. And I spoke with a guy at the utilities yesterday, and he said they don't have the capacity right now to meet that plant as well as meet peak load on their current, you know, capabilities. So they may be needing to look to either buy electricity on the market, or look at expanding how they generate electricity to meet that demand. So it's presenting a very real question in terms of what are the resources that the city has to serve this thing. And that being said, it's early in the process of looking at the environmental impacts and also looking at the capabilities of the city and how this is going to line up. So there's a lot more questions to answer, but preliminarily, those are the numbers that they have given me.
What about the economic impact? How big a deal could this be for Tacoma?
Big. 1,000 jobs initially, 260 jobs ongoing. But beyond that, if you look at income for the port, you're looking at, you know, lease upwards of $6 million a year, probably more than that. That's a very preliminary number that the port gave me. And then possibly 3 to 4 times that for the city from selling this company the water and the electricity. They'd be making that on tax revenues, of course. But, you know, that's a very, very, very ballpark figure right now. But it could be a lot of money for the city and for the port.
So what are elected officials saying?
The city council's been fairly neutral on this. I did interview Connie Bacon. She's a port commissioner. She's been on the port commission for 19 years. And she says this is a great idea. This is, you know, there are more questions to be answered for sure. But their job at the port is to bring in tenants to this space that is industrial. It's going to be about a 100-acre facility in their you know, real estate area down there that is heavily industrial now. So she's saying this is cleaner. You know, it's better than a coal terminal or an oil refinery. And it does provide jobs. And I also spoke to Mayor Strickland of Tacoma, and she says that she does have a lot of questions about this facility, and she wants to learn more, especially about how it fits in with the city's vision of itself in the coming years.
The interesting thing about Tacoma is that we have a very proud, rich, blue-collar history. And I think for some people, there's this idea that Tacoma should be a city that has just the arts, just cute restaurants, and just coffee shops. But if we are truly a diverse city, then our economy has to accommodate all kinds of work. And there's compelling reason to have heavy industry in our city because those jobs often pay well, and it respects the fact that different people have different skill sets, and more than anything else, we want people to have access to family wage jobs. But it really is a larger conversation about the risk and the benefits of doing something like this.
Thing she said is it does shine the light on the Port Commission. And like we saw in Seattle with the Shell oil rig that was here, nobody really pays attention to what's happening with the Port Commission until something like this happens. And this is Tacoma's Shell oil rig in a way. And so I think that it'll be interesting. You know, just I attended a public meeting that last night, actually, that was mobbed at the Tacoma Convention Center. And one guy actually stood up and called for the resignation of Connie Bacon, one of the Port Commissioners who signed this lease to at least preliminarily hold the spot for the refinery, the methanol refinery, should they get through the permitting process. So it's causing quite a stir.
Yeah. How heated is the debate getting?
You know, judging by last night, nobody in that room, there was one guy who stood up and said, representing union workers, and said, I told them not to come tonight because we felt that the previous hearing, public meeting, was a bit of a circus and that it was a hostile environment for people who support the plant. Everybody in that room that I saw last night was against it and was pretty angry about it. And, you know, to be clear, this is the scoping process. We're very early, and so this is a time for people to be asking questions about it. Many of the people in the room last night didn't seem to be, they were voicing questions and saying what they wanted explored, but they were also voicing strong opposition to this thing. It was very clear that this was not necessarily, this was in a way a referendum on the project itself.
Finally, what happens next with this possible huge methanol refinery in Tacoma?
Well, I mean, I think the most interesting thing about this story is the city is at a crossroads. Like, it's choosing between its industrial history and what the future vision of this city looks like. And so we're looking at a long environmental review. It's going to take about a year. At the end of this year, they're looking at getting the EIS, Environmental Impact Statement, complete. And the city will be overseeing that with the help of a consultant. And then it's got to get permits from several, potentially several federal agencies, as well as local clean air agencies and state agencies. So like the coal terminals we've seen, like the oil terminals we've seen, there is a long review process for these things. And we're at the very early stages. But I've been told by several people working down there on the project that this is the biggest thing to come on their desks for the city in a very, very long time. And it's going to be a long, drawn out fight, clearly, from what I saw last night at the public hearing.
You will hear more about this from KUOW's EarthFix reporter, Ashley Ahern. Thanks, Ashley.
Thank you.
Again, Tacoma could one day be home to the biggest methanol refinery in the world. This is The Record. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Good afternoon. A lot of teenagers have depression or anxiety. What's less talked about is psychotic disorders in teens. Radioactive youth producer Fallon brings us a personal story of one student's battle with a mental breakdown. We're not going to use Fallon's last name. That's to maintain medical privacy.
When I was in middle school, I was like any other nerdy teen. I was getting straight A's. I was in honors classes. I remember seeing my friends at the library every day. We would talk about Japanese anime and video games, and just stuff we liked. I'd go to class, and things were okay. But I just wasn't the same as everyone else. Things were sometimes bad at home. There was a lot of arguments and a lot of bad vibes. I wasn't sleeping much during that time. Once I went to school without sleeping at all. In high school, I started getting really depressed. I just didn't want to do anything anymore. I listened to Pink Floyd's The Wall on repeat. I was just in my own little world. My mom, Sheila, knew something was wrong.
You were somebody completely different. You just weren't you anymore.
I was diagnosed with psychosis at age 16. Psychosis is a brain disorder where someone has lost contact with reality. It was my sophomore year when my first real psychotic episode hit me. I was having delusions, which are thoughts and ideas that aren't real. Like I was scared my dad was going to kill me. I tried jumping out the window, running out the door. I did everything I could to escape the situation. My mom realized that I really needed help. She called the crisis line. Apparently I made the call with her, but I don't remember. The crisis line told them to take me to the emergency room at University Hospital. When we got there, they put me in the psych ward and things got worse. I thought the police were interrogating my family because they were planning to kill me. I thought they were taking me to prison and across the ocean. There were so many delusions that I thought were happening, but they weren't real. My mom was under a lot of stress during that time. She wishes she could have said,
how I didn't blame you for any of it. How I felt like it was my job to protect you, and I didn't. And I'm sorry.
They took me to Fairfax Psychiatric Hospital in Kirkland. I remember being put on a stretcher in an ambulance. The lady in the ambulance was really nice. She took off the straps from my wrist so I could scratch my itchy nose. At Fairfax, they took my picture and then wheeled me into the unit. Inside the room at Fairfax, there were 3 beds and a desk. Everything was bolted to the floor. I made up one of the beds. There were 2 other people in the room and they were joking around. It still hadn't hit me exactly where I was. I'd always wondered what a psychiatric hospital would be like, and there I was. It was not at all how I thought it would be. It was very structured there. We'd line up and take pills every morning. You'd have to write your name on a board and wait in line and take a shower. It was a tiny little shower, and you had to keep pressing the button to make the water run. There was group therapy. We'd have art. There was time to get exercise, and we mostly played volleyball. Every day we talked to our psychiatrist, and we'd write down a goal for each day. We had to make our beds every morning. Not only that, but we had to ask for our personal items at the nurse's station, like your comb or your lotion. A few days after I'd gotten to Fairfax, they put me on a new medication. That's when things started to change. Within a couple days, my thoughts were clearing, and I started to look back on all the things I was thinking and realized, okay, that's not right. None of that was real. Through it all, my grandma, grandpa, mom, and dad came to see me every day. They were all there for me, but it was really surreal to see them for an hour and then just have them leave. I talked to my grandma about that time.
How did you feel about me being in the hospital?
Worried and things, because it was your first time ever being away from home.
I remember when I told my family the news that I'd be leaving the hospital soon. They were really happy. The biggest key to how I was able to bounce back was that I got help as early as possible. A lot of people say getting help as soon as possible is important to keep the illness from getting worse. But not many people recognize the signs early on. Here's what my mom has to say about this.
And if your daughter or your son or your friend or your grandma or your grandpa tells you there's something wrong and they don't feel right, then you need to take them seriously. Because the sooner you get them help, the better.
The day I left Fairfax, I put all my stuff in a big plastic bag. They opened the big doors and I got to leave. My family picked me up. We drove home, and it felt like it took forever. I knew I was better. When I got into my old room, my family had switched around the bed and put it in a new bookshelf. It was just really nice. It looked different, and I felt different and new. But I felt so happy that I didn't have to be locked in anywhere. To this day, I'm still on medication to prevent from having another psychotic episode. I'm taking my medication. It's small, round, white, 15 milligrams. I take my medication every morning. Okay. Now hopefully I won't get over emotional during the day. A couple weeks after I got home from Fairfax, things started to feel more normal. I went back to school. No one had any idea where I had been, but when I told them that I had stayed at a psychiatric hospital, they were accepting and cool with it. It still weighed heavily on my family and didn't just affect me, but them too. I have a ton of questions that I still think about, but no one can tell me if what happened is a part of something bigger or not. I don't completely know if this is something I'm going to have to live with for the rest of my life, and I don't know if it'll ever happen again. It's scary to live with, but I know me and my family are prepared.
There's no right or wrong way to handle something like that. You just have to go through it. And it's made us both very strong.
Radioactive, this is your dude, Fallon.
I love you.
I love you too, honey.
Fallon decided to share this story to let other young people struggling with mental illness know they're not alone. The story was produced in KUOW's Radioactive Youth Media Workshop at the Columbia City Library in Seattle. Connect with us on Facebook at Radioactive Youth Media. Now on KUOW, let's learn more about psychotic disorders in young people. I talked with Dr. Jack McClellan, medical director of the Child Study and Treatment Center in Lakewood, the state's psychiatric hospital for children. And he told me about some of the most common psychotic disorders and their symptoms.
the classic psychotic illness is schizophrenia, and that person or that illness is really defined by problems with having hallucinations, seeing things other people don't see, sometimes or hearing things other people can't hear, as well as having delusions, false beliefs, either paranoid beliefs or beliefs that your mind is magical or playing tricks. Manic depressive illness or bipolar disorder always includes something called a manic episode, where a person has this marked change in their behavior where they stop sleeping at night, have all this energy, often develop these unusual or bizarre beliefs about special powers that they have. And that especially teenagers with mania will often present acutely psychotic. And again, it's often a delusion that they have that either they're a famous person or God sent them on earth to do some special task. And that those symptoms can obviously get them in a lot of trouble.
What causes that?
We don't know the causes for most of it. A lot of the causes appear to be genetic, that there's some sort of change in the way the brain is functioning. It's not something that parents cause by the way that they parent or the stresses in school. Stress can certainly add to it and make the illnesses work, but the underlying causes has something to do more with the person's brain.
What is extra tricky about diagnosing psychosis in a young person?
In general, in psychiatry, and particularly with psychosis, we don't have any blood tests, we don't have any x-ray findings to tell us that someone has an illness. It's all based on an interview. And if you ask children how often a child hears a voice, about 1 in 5 kids will tell you that they hear a voice. And that's really, and for the most part, most of those kids do not have a psychotic illness and will never get a psychotic illness. It's due to their imagination or anxiety or experiences that they've had, but it's not a true psychotic symptom.
What are the challenges in treating psychotic illnesses in children?
Part of the challenge is both true for adults and for children. The medicines are not perfect. They don't cure the disorder. They certainly reduce the symptoms, and they sometimes allow a person to function much more normally than what they otherwise can. But they all have side effects. And that so you're taking a young person and exposing them to what may be a lifelong treatment and starting with side effects very early on in their life. And that's a difficult thing. It's also clearly a problem that not everyone responds to the first or the second medicine that you try. And so you have to sometimes go a long period of time of trying different things before you find something that works.
You are a believer in medication.
For this illness, certainly. That without this illness, people can be severely impaired with lifelong problems.
How often does a psychotic disorder go away by itself as the kid grows?
If you follow kids over time that have these disorders, most continue to have some evidence of the illness over time, although they can do a lot better with treatment. And sometimes it does just seem to go away. You'll follow up in 3 or 4 years, and the kid no longer has that illness. And I wish I could tell you we don't really understand why that is, but it does happen in some people.
Where do you think we are in our understanding? Where do you see our progress, our hope in treating kids with these illnesses?
In the past 5 to 10 years, the ability to find genetic mutations has grown enormously in science, and that a lot of these illnesses really do come from genetic mutations. And so the ability to find those and figure out what they do in regards to how the brain works is really important. That none of the treatments that we have right now are based on any known cause. And if you figure out what causes something, you're much more likely to come up with a treatment that's better and works is more specific.
A lot of what we think we know about the mind is from our friends or from media, social media. What's the biggest misconception we have when it comes to young people and psychosis?
Psychosis below the age of 12 is really, really rare. That these illnesses usually start somewhere between the ages of 15 and 30, and it's really a young adulthood kind of illness. And so it doesn't mean the kid may not have other problems. Kids, for example, with anxiety often report things that sound psychotic. Kids who have been traumatized or who have been abused sometimes report things that sound psychotic. So it doesn't mean that those kids don't need treatment, but calling it psychosis may lead you down the wrong treatment path.
Doctor, you only treat kids, right?
Yes. Yeah, I'm a child psychiatrist.
What drove you to make this your career?
Partly, I think it is one of the most significant public health problems that we have. These are lifelong illnesses. They impact a person's ability to socially function as well as their ability to go to work or to go to school. And if you can find treatments that work better, if you can find causes, you really can make a significant change in not only those people's lives, but our entire public health system.
University of Washington psychiatry professor Jack McClellan is medical director of the state psychiatric hospital for children, the Child Study and Treatment Center in Lakewood. Now we meet two migrants who found a new life here in Seattle. If you saw Nayef Rebid and Betu Lami walking around together in their Capitol Hill neighborhood, they probably wouldn't stand out. You would never guess that they met doing very dangerous jobs in one of the world's most dangerous places. 12 years ago, Nayef was a translator for the Marines in Iraq, and Betu was a soldier in the new Iraqi army. They met while stationed in a house in Ramadi, a city crippled by near-constant battle between allied forces and insurgent fighters. That's where the two started talking and started to fall for each other. Nayef told me what he and Betu found to talk about in that house in Ramadi.
I was working with the U.S. Marines as translator. He was one of the soldiers with the new Iraqi armies. And also they sent us to was a very dangerous area called Ramadi, and put us in a house in the middle of this city full of terrorists. And every day and night he been inviting me, and we sit at night and we talk, and that's how we start know each other and like each other more.
What would you talk about?
We was looking only for one beautiful things can let us forget where are we now and where we feeling, because, you know, it's arms, is we see dead people, it's fight. So what we talking about is about our life and past, about how we feel, about where we like to be in the future. And that was very beautiful in that difficult moment.
Were you openly gay at the time, both of you? Did you know?
First time, no.
When you first met?
Yeah, we cannot say like we are gay for each other.
Yeah. First 4 days, I told you, I love you. You don't answer. Just you kiss me and you leave. I'm come back in my bed. And 2 days, I'm not eat anything. Yeah. I'm so excited. But same time, this is danger. And in Iraqi, sergeant, in 15 years, you count in the...
You mean if they find us we gay in Iraqi law, it's 15 years being in jail.
Yeah.
So to be gay in Iraq, it's very dangerous. It's losing your life. You getting ashamed to the family. The family, you lose your family and you lose your friends. You lose everything almost. So that's why there is other ways to be gay, just to be between you and yourself and maybe the other person.
How did you come to leave Iraq?
For me, I get dangerous not just because I'm gay. It's because I work with the U.S. military, which is they start writing our names in the street and I cannot meet my family anymore.
You're being targeted by Iraqis.
Targeted by the militias, by a lot of people. And all my neighborhood know I work with Americans, so they call me traitor. Yeah. And in that time, I applied for the asylum, and I get it in 2009. So in 2009, that was the most difficult time for me because I'm living alone without him.
How were you doing at that time?
I like it. I love it. He's safe. But
you like that he's safe.
Yeah, he goes safe life. Or he now told everyone on the outside, I'm gay. He welcome in United States. But me, I live in Iraq. Is now just me, and so difficult.
So in that time, I was feeling very guilty to leave him behind. We've been since we met. Till this day, we never any day pass without we talking together. By phones, by Skype, by almost everything. We use everything. He been spending most his money he get it from the military to buy a cart to speak with me by phones. Because when I come here first time, I was kind of broken, you know, and I have a job and I have that much money to buy the cards and call.
Yeah, he moved in United States. He just have $50.
$50.
Yeah, in my pocket.
And Nayef, you worked for years to get Betu here to the States. First, you got him out of Iraq to Lebanon. Then from Lebanon to Vancouver, Canada. You married in Canada, but you didn't have a visa. Then it was a little more than a year ago you finally got an appointment with U.S. immigration offices in Montreal. Tell us about that day.
And that day was one of my biggest days ever. So we went there, and I was having like punch of paper, all my trips to him when he was in Beirut and when he was... All our pictures since 2004.
Photos, letters.
Photos, letters, yeah, all to prove our relationship. That time was 10 years. And the interview was only 10 minutes. She asked him a specific question about how we met, how long we'll be together, and how we connect with together. And after that, she said, you've been approved for a visa to live in the United States and blah, blah. And I say, excuse me, what did you just say? And she said, yeah. So he got approved to go in and say, and I was like, do you just say that? And I start crying and scream, and he said, don't scream in here, at least just go outside the building. And I was like holding my mouth like this, but cry like I lost myself like really, because it's finally is happening. We could live together. I'm not just him in Vancouver or in Lebanon or in Iraq, and I have to visit and I have to speak with him every day by Skype or by phone or by any device, because I'm tired from this. It's the time I want to wake up, see him in front of me. And when I close my eyes, he's the last face I see.
How has your life changed since you are now living in Seattle?
Anything in the change now?
A lot of things change.
Yeah, now we have home. Apartment, but
it's like a palace for us.
Yeah,
like a no. What?
Palace.
A palace. Yeah. A palace. Your apartment is like a palace.
Yes.
Yeah. Now
we have our dream wedding.
Oh my wedding! Oh my God! It's really dream.
You know, we always was imagine our wedding and what are we gonna say it, what are we gonna do, but the wedding is just come more about what we imagine. It's because with all this friends been supporting us. All those beautiful people, we just have an amazing, beautiful day.
Yes, I love him, he loves me. We now 12 years together. Oh, I think you're more 50 or 55 years more, we together.
That is Beitu Lami. He and Nayef Rebid got married here this past summer. They met 12 years ago during the Iraq War while Beitu was a soldier in the Iraqi army and Nayef was a translator for the U.S. Marines. This is KUOW's The Record. Now, the big science news of the day. Scientists have detected gravitational waves, ripples in the space-time continuum. One theorist says this ranks with Galileo taking up a telescope and looking at the planets. And the evidence was recorded. One of the scientists called it the soundtrack of the universe.
Sounds like the ocean,
says Ben Mata, middle school science student at Sky Valley Education in Monroe. Ben says this discovery of two black holes colliding is so cool because it proves a theory of Albert Einstein's that's about a century old.
Well, it's kind of amazing that Einstein discovered this. Like, probably without sensors, he just calculated it. I care about this because it's a new discovery and... it could lead to something like black holes not destroying the universe when they collide.
Yeah, black holes can collide and we're still okay.
Yeah.
And that's the take on today's big science news from Snohomish County middle schooler Ben Mata. Excited to learn that an all-star international team of astrophysicists has detected gravitational waves. Ripples in the fabric of space-time. We're going to tell you more about gravitational waves here in the next few minutes, unless space-time ripples again, here on KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. Live tweeting at KUOW.